This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, a labor expert walks us through the current job market and labor changes we might see in the future. Now, a bipartisan group of lawmakers in Congress reached a deal aimed at reducing gun violence over the weekend. The framework would provide more funding for states to create red flag laws, increase background checks for gun buyers under 21, and step up financial support for community mental health clinics. There's still a lot to do before it has a chance of becoming law, and reaction has been mixed. Some gun safety advocates saying it doesn't go far enough, some gun rights supporters opposing red flag laws in particular. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about this potential for action on gun laws and school safety? Do you think this could reduce gun violence? Are there other policies, that you want to see Congress take up to deal with gun violence in the United States? What do you think about the idea of red flag laws in particular? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Adam Winkler is professor at the University of California, Los Angeles School of Law. He's also author of the book Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. Adam, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much for having me, Rob.
Well, this is still in some ways early stages. How significant is what we're seeing so far from this bipartisan group of Senate negotiators?
Well, there's two ways to measure it. One, how significant will it be in terms of reducing gun violence? Well, I think these are measures in the right direction. Most of them are pretty moderate, and so I wouldn't expect it to have a big impact, certainly not immediately, on gun violence numbers. The second way to measure it is, you know, what does passage of this bill mean for gun policy in America more generally? And if we can break the logjam that has prevented any new consideration of significant reform for over 10 years since the Newtown shooting, well, then this might be a breakthrough that could lead potentially to future reforms. Again, maybe of a small and moderate character, but ones that move the ball a little bit forward down the field each time.
We got an email from Matt in Madison who says, because nothing happened after Sandy Hook, he writes, I'm convinced that we aren't going to do anything now. Matt goes on, Republicans will water anything down. States will then feed on the carcass of gun regulations. I hope I'm wrong, but nothing in the past indicates this time will be any different. Matt, skeptical there, clearly, that anything significant is going to happen.
Well, it's hard to argue with Matt's skepticism. I mean, it's based in reality. We've seen, sort of been to this space time and time again, and only to walk away disappointed, and with the gun violence problem only seeming to get worse. It does seem that reports from Washington suggest that there may be more momentum than we have seen in a long time, and it's also the case that the particular measures that are being considered are reasonably moderate, not likely to have a significant burden on law-abiding gun owners, not going to have the big impact on criminal violence and reducing gun violence that maybe some gun safety advocates had hoped for. But part of the gun safety advocates' political problem in recent years has been aiming too high for things like bans on assault weapons or high-capacity magazines, things that are certain to get the gun owners really riled up and to increase the opposition to their proposals.
One of the most directly gun-related parts of this plan would be the red flag law. Some states have these already. Florida, among them, people point to as a Republican state that passed a red flag law. This, as I understand it, this plan wouldn't impose a federal red flag law. It would help states who want to do it. Can you talk about red flag laws, their potential impact?
Yeah, red flag laws are a relatively recent phenomenon. They've been passed, though, in a number of states, both red states and blue states, and they provide family members, for instance, who see someone who is in crisis but has possession of firearms, this enables them to go to court and just temporarily take away those firearms. Those firearms will be eventually returned to the person, but it brings in the judicial process and a little oversight and supervision, which can be a really helpful thing when you see young people in particular who are struggling with the onset of mental illness or having other struggles, but they're armed. Maybe this can help reduce some gun violence, maybe by reducing suicide or reducing some mass shootings. Again, it's not going to have a big effect in the sense that it's hard to predict when someone's going to be violent, but it does provide that opportunity. One of the big criticisms of red flag laws is that the person who is affected is generally not involved in the process, and so they don't get a right to state their view and to appear in court. So far, courts have upheld these laws as constitutionally permissible. But you could see why there is some opposition there.
Right. The Wisconsin Republican Party state convention passed a resolution back in April opposing red flag laws. They labeled them as gun confiscation laws disguised as gun violence prevention, said they were unconstitutional prior restraint. So Republicans control the legislature in Wisconsin. They will likely continue to do so after the elections. So if the federal government passes a law helping red flags laws get passed in states, but states don't want them, does it really make much of a difference?
Not going to make a difference at all in many states. The states that are really opposed to having red flag laws will just not form them. The federal proposal that we've seen so far would be one that only provides grants, funding for states, and provides some framework for them to set up these laws. But if a state is dead set opposed to these laws, they won't be required to do so. There has been some pushback from House Democrats to change that, to make it so that there is a federal red flag law where you could go to a federal court in any state in the nation and seek one of these extreme risk protection orders. But we'll have to see how that shakes out when the details of the deal really come out.
Talking to Adam Winkler from the UCLA School of Law, author of the book Gunfight, looking at a tentative deal in the U.S. Senate on some gun violence prevention efforts, school safety, mental health, also part of the picture here. Now, also included in this, changing the way background checks work for people under 21, as I understand it, Adam, taking into account juvenile criminal records. What are we seeing there?
Well, their proposal does mean that they're going to improve the background check system by including juvenile mental health and criminal justice records for those purchasing guns before the age of 21. This would be a moderate improvement in the sense that, look, if someone has a record that does create problems or suspicions that they will likely be violent with a firearm, if they have one of these predictable variables in their background, then it's good to get that into the background check system. This is going to be a difficult one to be fully implemented, though. Many states do not collect this data as a matter of course, and the NICS background check system for federal gun transfers requires state data reporting into the federal system. The federal government doesn't have its own mechanism to do it. So to the extent the states don't already have good systems in place to gather and report this kind of information, the background check system won't be as effective as it might otherwise be.
There have also been some headlines about the boyfriend loophole when it comes to gun purchases and domestic violence. What do people mean by that?
Well, current law, under the current federal law, bars people who are domestic abusers from possessing firearms. However, that only applies to a domestic abuser who is also a spouse. And so gun safety advocates have been pushing for years to expand the definition of who could be included in this domestic abuser prohibition, and including those who are in a dating relationship with the particular person. And so this is a good expansion of the prohibition on domestic abusers, in that we know that there are plenty of people who are together who are not married but pose the same domestic violence problems. And one of the best predictors for someone using firearms against their significant other or partner is a history of domestic abuse. So these are definitely the people we want to keep away from having guns.
It can be tough to thread the needle between something that's going to be, as you say, effective in reducing gun violence and something that'll get enough political support to pass and that'll pass Supreme Court muster. Do you think there are any missed opportunities to do something that meets all three of those criteria in what we're seeing from the Senate?
Well, Rob, that's a great point you make about the Supreme Court and the Second Amendment, because so far the Second Amendment has not been a big barrier to gun safety reform in the courts. Courts have mostly upheld gun laws, but the Supreme Court seems to be on the precipice of a major change on the Second Amendment. There's a big Second Amendment case coming down any day now from the Supreme Court where they're likely to raise the constitutional bar for any gun safety law. And I think that if this Senate deal had included some of the things that Democrats were pushing for, like bans on assault weapons or bans on high-capacity magazines, it's very likely that would have resulted in a constitutional challenge and one that might very well have proven successful to overturn those laws. So one of the things I think is important about this Senate deal is that it is a series of moderate measures. Gun violence is only going to be reduced in America by a series of moderate measures, not by these big, high-profile things like taking away assault weapons that as you point out, may really just run into ultimate problems in the courts.
Adam Winkler is with us, Second Amendment expert, professor at the UCLA School of Law, with us today for a look at a bipartisan deal in Congress on red flag laws, mental health funding, school safety, resources, all efforts to reduce the impact of gun violence, gun homicide, and suicide. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the deal, what you've heard about it so far? Do you want to see Congress pass something? If so, what? Do you think this doesn't go far enough? Are there other measures you'd like to see? Do you worry about some of the elements, like red flag laws? Should we have those kind of laws here in Wisconsin? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk about a bipartisan deal, tentative deal, at least in the U.S. Senate, aimed at reducing gun violence. Adam Winkler stays with us from UCLA's School of Law. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you hope gets passed by Congress? What do you fear could be passed by Congress? What, if any, changes would you want to see when it comes to gun laws in the United States? Red flag laws, one thing on the table here. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email us, ideas@WPR.org. Looking at the rest of the bill, Adam, some school safety measures, some mental health funding. How significant is that?
Well, these are good things. I mean, it depends on what the actual funding is and what is actually being, how much funding there is for school safety. It's clear we do have a very big problem in this country. We have an armed society for good or ill. And one of the ills of having an armed society is that people who really want to engage in violence have a ready means to do so. Those guns are here to stay when we have a right to bear arms. And so having better security in places where vulnerable people gather is an important part of the overall picture of sort of suite of reforms that you need for gun safety reduction. And mental health is a particularly important area because it's an area where in American public services, we've really reduced the amount of health care funding and health care services out there. And to the extent that we see gun violence as one problem that is sometimes associated with mental health, I should be clear that not always and not often, but it's something that can be helpful and might even be useful in providing mental health services to people who are considering suicide, which is, of course, the vast majority of gun deaths every year, even though it's the problem that we almost rarely talk about.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Dan is with us in Appleton. Dan, hi.
Hey, good afternoon. I would have liked to see them raise the purchase age to 21 across the board. Just there's, what is it, 6 and 9 in the last, since 2018, were 18, 19-year-olds. I don't think there's a practical way to ban assault rifles or high-capacity magazines. The Clintons didn't do it, and there's like 20 million of them afloat.
I gotcha. Dan, thanks for the call. This was something people were talking about, Adam, that didn't end up in this deal, changing the age to purchase firearms from 18 to 21 for all firearms, some people said, or semi-automatic weapons, or the sort of loosely defined assault weapon category.
Well, this would have been, I think, a worthwhile reform. I've written for a few years about the importance of raising the gun age. And this is not based on anything other than good brain science, like what we know about the brain and how the brain processes information in terms of long-term consequences, risk-taking behavior. We know that the brain really changes when the brain gets a little bit older. And so to the extent that we could move people from 18 to 21 to get their hands on firearms, I think that would be very helpful, not only for reducing some of the mass shootings, because I don't think there's much data to support that mass shootings overall are committed by particularly young people, even though the caller, Dan, was right that a couple recent ones are young people. But young people, of course, are much more apt to commit suicide with firearms than people who are more established age. And it might be the kind of thing that can help in that space, too.
Thanks a lot for that call. We got an email from Adrian in Wauwatosa who says, "My sister died by suicide 4 years ago thanks to easy access to a firearm. Adrian goes on, had there been some red flag indicating her suicidality, selling her that gun that day may have deterred her access to the surest way of her death. You just mentioned suicide being the leading cause of death by firearm. How could red flag laws in particular impact that, Adam?
Well, the idea of the red flag laws is that where family members who might be the most likely to know that someone's going through a crisis, it gives them some ability to go to court and say, hey, this person is a threat. They're a danger to themselves and to others. We already allow people to go to courts and get people to be put on a 72-hour hold. We take all of their liberty away, right? We put them in a 72-hour hold if they're going through a crisis. This is basically something similar that family members can use and would take the firearms away for, say, a month. We'll have to see what the federal law and conditions are, but red flags often will do something like limit the guns for a month. And that kind of temporary confiscation can really help where family members see someone in crisis. We talk about mass shootings, but well over 60% of gun deaths every year are suicide, and we know from the data that if we can reduce access to firearms by people who contemplate suicide, it's much more likely that their suicide attempt will be unsuccessful and that they'll go on to have potentially rich and full lives.
Adrian, thank you so much for sharing that, and so sorry for the loss of your sister. Let's go back to our callers now. David is with us in Grand Marsh. David, hello.
Hey, hello. Great topic, and I just wanted to share some experiences that I've had, you know, living in different countries, how they approach guns, and it's so different. And I want to say something, but I don't want to offend anybody. But it seems like different cultures, different countries, they value the safety of their kids a lot more than we do. And I'm not saying that you know, American parents don't value their kids' lives. I'm telling you that American society doesn't value their kids' lives and the safety of their kids like other countries do. And if I could just say that, you know, the inactivity of our government into not addressing this sooner is an embarrassment. It really is.
David, thanks for the call. Adam, what do you think?
Well, you know, I've never really studied whether we value children less than other countries, but it does certainly seem like that we are not as motivated to act when we see a lot of children dying that one might hope we would be. But at the same time, I think it's a difficult issue because David makes some great points, but there's also the point that, you know, for many gun owners in America, they believe that the answer is more guns. That the answer to providing safety in a community and a society that where there's already 400 million guns, the answer is in arming teachers and arming people on the street so that they can defend themselves. And whether you agree with that perspective or not, I think it's worthwhile to recognize that some people do genuinely believe it, and that makes them very reluctant to agree to gun safety reform laws when they think, hey, the criminals are all going to still have guns, and there'll just be no one around to protect them.
Thanks for that call. Mary joins us next in Eau Claire. Mary, hello.
Hello. I want to point out that I think the Republicans are duping us with this watered-down bill because if it passes and there is no significant reduction in gun violence, they will say, see, regulations don't work, and we're going to be stuck with this watered-down bill for another 3 or 4 decades. I suppose it's better than nothing. But this idea that it's a first step to better regulations, I think, is baloney.
Mary, thanks for the call. Adam?
Well, again, Mary's cynicism, it's hard to argue with based on what we've seen in American politics lately. The one way I think about it is that, look, our political system is broken. We can't get Congress to pass meaningful reform in almost any area of law, much less in one so controversial as guns and gun policy, that to reduce gun violence will require not just one simple solution, but a suite of reforms that try to target little pieces of the gun violence problem in all its different ways, from suicide to mass shooting to criminal violence to accidents. it takes a different approach for all of those things. And so having at least opening up the possibility that we can have more serious conversations about what we need to do to reform guns seems to me to be a worthwhile chance to take. But Mary's cynicism is certainly well-earned in American politics recently.
Mary, thanks for the call. Adam, I'm seeing some reporting that Republicans, after these last couple of mass shootings, some Republicans in Congress and in the House and the Senate are feeling some constituent pressure to do something. Maybe not everything, maybe not huge changes, but to be seen doing something. Do you think there's any kind of change going on here at that local level that politicians are feeling the heat?
Well, you know, I think it's going to be one of the real questions that comes out of this reform. If it passes the Senate, and which would require at least 10 Republican votes, what does the November election tell us about this vote? Do those who have supported this legislation get voted out? Do those who supported this legislation find that there's their electoral chances have been reduced significantly? That the NRA says, "Hey, oppose this candidate," and promises that there's going to be a backlash with taking away your endorsements and things like that? Well, then we might see that Republicans who support this bill will never support another one in the future. So I think it's one of the real interesting questions to see what happens if it passes in terms of, is there that kind of political backlash?
And just briefly, do you think it's likely that this is going to end up passing?
Well, you know, tea leaves are best left for making tea, probably, Rob. You know, predicting the future is never my strong suit. I've got a pretty bad track record. So I don't know. It does seem like there's more momentum than ever. But I guess I'll be with Dan and Mary and some of your other callers who had a little cynicism about whether this will get passed or not. I certainly wouldn't bet my house on it.
Adam, we'll leave it there. Thanks, as always, for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Adam Winkler, professor at the UCLA School of Law, author of the book Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. He was with us today to talk about a new bipartisan plan in the U.S. Senate involving some gun regulation changes, school safety and mental health funding, and what comes next as lawmakers work to pass a bill into law. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, Kate talks to the chairs of Wisconsin's Democratic and Republican parties for a look at priorities in this year's midterm elections, gun laws, and the latest from the January 6th committee. That's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, the House committee investigating January 6th turns its focus to former President Donald Trump. How did months of misinformation play into the Capitol attack? Find out more today at 6 on 1A+. Now, the COVID-19 pandemic disrupted many aspects of life, including the job market. For quite a while now, people have been leaving jobs, in many cases, to move to another job in a tight labor market. And according to some federal data, many people who might otherwise have gone to college are opting to go into the workforce instead of pursuing higher education. Many employers are offering higher pay and better benefits, but will that last? We'll hear from an expert on what the future of labor might look like in the United States, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you in a better job than you were in before the pandemic started? Have you chosen not to work or to change the kind of job you do, change your career? Why have you decided to go into college or maybe your kid? Or if you were on the fence about college, how did you weigh the decision of higher education or maybe taking a job that paid more than it did a couple years ago? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Enrique Lopez Lira is director of the Low Wage Work Program at the University of California, Berkeley Labor Center. He researches policies related to the racial and gender equity of working families. Enrique, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I referred to, you know, lots of people leaving their jobs. People call it the Great Resignation or the quitting. You say that doesn't really sum up what's happening very well. How do you read the number of people leaving their jobs and maybe just switching to another job?
Yeah, I believe the Great Resignation term is not quite adequate. I prefer the term that was coined by Professor Dubay, Great Reshuffling, because what we are seeing is that people are leaving their jobs, but they're going to pursue some of the better jobs out there right now, the better paying jobs. And so the numbers show a lot of people leaving, but also a lot of people being rehired and potentially better paying, better quality jobs. And so it's more of a reshuffling than a resignation.
Your work focuses a lot on people at lower wage levels. What has this all meant for them, this tight labor market? Is it paying off significantly for people in those lower paying jobs?
Yeah, it's a great question. We definitely are seeing higher wage growth at the bottom of the wage distribution. And the pandemic really hit low wage workers the hardest for many reasons. But one of them is that the shutdown of the economy particularly hurt leisure and hospitality industries and retail, and those tend to hire a larger proportion of low-wage workers. And so for us, we want to make sure that the recovery is helping those that were hurt the most. Now, wages did not grow very fast after the last recession, and it took a while for wages started picking back up. And even after they picked up, it was only slightly compared to workers making much higher wages. So the higher wages we're seeing for those low wage workers today is very much welcome, because these workers have been struggling for so long to catch up to the rest of the workforce.
One of the things that prompted this conversation, we saw a piece in the New York Times saying, you know, a lot of people who might have been in the market for higher education, going to a community college or other, or maybe a 4-year school, saying, you know, these jobs I can get now, they're paying pretty good. I'm going to put off or even skip a higher education. Is that something you've been watching for?
A little bit. I mean, it's true that in economics and in labor studies, we tend to focus more on the impact on employment from higher wages. And so there's not a lot as much robust research on what happens to what we call, you know, human capital accumulation, or what people do to gain skills when wages rise. And, you know, and if you just think in pure economic theory terms, when the price of something goes up, people tend to do less of that. And so if you think of the price of college as the income you give up, then wages rising now means that the price of going to college has gone up instead of just going to work. And so people are going to choose to work rather than go to college. However, like I said, you know, that's theory. And the question is, does the data bear that out? There was a study done recently last year, I believe, but it was looking at Canadian data. And what it found is that when wages went up, people tended to enroll in community college, probably because those colleges offer occupational training and licensing and those kind of vocational skills rather than university. But the folks who were enrolling primarily were adults, not so much, you know, the younger teenagers who are deciding, do I go to university or do I go to work after high school? What we're seeing, what was shown in that study was it was older workers. Now, if you look at low wage work, it kind of makes sense, because people tend to think of low wage work as like young people working in fast food. But the reality is that most low wage work is done by adults. And so adults probably would want to take advantage of higher paying occupations, but they feel like they need to get an additional licensing. But if you're an older worker, it doesn't necessarily mean that you're a full-time student. You might just be going to community college and at night and still working in the daytime.
We are talking about the job market now and in the future. Enrique Lopez Lira is with us from the Low Wage Work Program at the University of California, Berkeley Labor Center. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you changed jobs? Has your job changed since the pandemic started? Have you moved into something higher paying? Call 800-642-1234. If you're an employer, what are you seeing in this tight labor market? Can you hire people? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Let's go to a caller now. Brian is with us near Black River Falls. Hi, Brian.
Hi, good afternoon. Trucker Brian here.
What do you think, Brian?
Well, I think I'd love to see legislation in the United States of America where it says when a company or corporation makes X amount of dollars profit, they'll just turn around at the end of the year and give the employees a healthy bonus. Game over. Legislation does that. Now maybe get rid of the unions, and then they can, instead of paying union dues, now you can take your kids to a soccer game, buy them hockey gloves or ice cream. Why doesn't legislation kick in with something that mandatory an employer has to kick back to the employees a healthy bonus at the end of the year?
Brian, thanks for the call. Enrique, that reminds me, you see charts every now and then going from like the 70s and 80s, through the last few years, showing, you know, productivity in the U.S. economy going up, oftentimes corporate profits going up, wages, especially at those lower levels, stagnating. Whether it's Brian's particular legislative idea or something else, do you see that as a problem?
Oh, definitely. And you're absolutely right about those charts. And however, one of the reasons for those charts is because of the demise of unions during that period when union membership was at its highest. That's when you saw the higher wage growth in those lower wage occupations, and you actually had a robust and thriving middle class. And so I agree to the caller, with the caller to an extent. There's a lot of talk about the higher wages today, but if you look at it, corporate profits are even higher and almost at record levels. And so there's a lot of talk about, you know, wages driving some of the price increases that we're seeing in the economy. But I would argue that corporate profits have a much bigger factor in that than wages. And so if you look at the public opinion today, unions have some of the highest public opinion since the 60s. And it's because people are finally realizing that a lot of the gains of that productivity have been accruing to the corporations and the executives run as corporations, and not to the workers who are actually providing the production that is reflected in those productivity gains.
Brian, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Joe joins us next in Madison. Joe, hi.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for having me. In my personal situation, I've been very fortunate due to the COVID lockdown and, you know, the extra government stimulus. You know, I quit my career of 18 years of being a chef, and I started my own business as a contractor. You know, there's a lot of low barriers to entry into it, and, you know, the economy, at least here in Madison, was doing really well, and we just hit our first year and been doing great. And, you know, hiring people that I've known my whole life, and, you know, we had a nice run there where for 6 months is like, yeah, you know, I'm paying everybody, you know, $20 to $30 an hour, depending on their skill level. I felt really happy that I was able to pay these guys so well. But, you know, now we see everything going up, and it's just like, well, now it's just going to be par for the course again. But, yeah, you know, all in all, I've just been really lucky, and COVID actually helped me, you know, in the great resignation, if you will.
Joe, thanks a lot for sharing your story. Enrique, I know I talked to some people early in the COVID era, both when restaurants were closed and as they started to reopen, a sense that a lot of people might leave service type jobs like that, vulnerable to COVID, people not being treated very well, honestly, by customers when they returned. Do you think there are a lot of stories like Joe's out there?
Yeah, we definitely have seen a lot of anecdotal evidence similar to Joe's. We forget that we're still in a pandemic, and we haven't officially declared the pandemic as concluded, and it's great to see wages go up, but the quality of these jobs has not improved. A lot of these jobs still have very uncertain schedule for workers, which makes it very hard to plan with family and vacations and doctor visits. A lot of these jobs don't have healthcare benefits. A lot of these jobs don't have paid sick leave or retirement. And it's really hard for a lot of these workers to work from home to do these jobs. And so we do see in the data still some workers who are not back into the workforce because they're still afraid of their health of the fact that we're still in a pandemic and the jobs they've been doing don't offer the protections that they would like. So I think it's great if you can switch careers and improve your situation. But for many workers, that's just not a possibility.
Joe, thanks a lot for sharing your story. We're talking to Enrique Lopez Lira, director of the Low Wage Work Program at the University of California, Berkeley Labor Center. He's with us to talk about the current job market, a tight labor market, how that might change in the future for employees and employers. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. How has the pandemic economy affected you? Have you changed your job at some point? Have you had trouble hiring people? And did you change college plans based on the availability of jobs, you or maybe your potentially college-bound kid? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We continue our talk with Enrique Lopez Lira, director of the Low Wage Work Program at the University of California, Berkeley Labor Center, looking at the job market, a tight labor market now. A lot of people still apparently switching jobs and what the future could hold. And you can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, your thoughts, maybe your stories. Are you an employer who's hiring right now? What are you seeing out there? Have you had to change things in your business to draw people in? Are you looking for a job from a position of not having a job at all or maybe looking for a switch? What are you seeing out there right now? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Enrique, you were just talking about, you know, jobs, some of the lower wage jobs maybe paying better now, but not seeing some of those fundamental changes you mentioned, predictable working hours, health benefits, sick days, that kind of thing. Do you see any kind of movement in that direction now, though?
Well, we're seeing a lot of workers, voting with their feet, so to speak, by switching jobs. But we're also seeing a movement of workers trying to use this opportunity of a tight labor market to gain worker power and improve the conditions for themselves and their coworkers. So we've seen that in places that have unions where they've gone on strike, like in Kellogg's. But also seeing it in places that don't have unions where workers are starting to unionize or behave as if they were part of a union and collectively try to bargain with their employers. And so we're seeing some increase in unionization in places that didn't have unions before, like Starbucks, some of it in Amazon, but also seeing it in other places that, you know, they don't have a union, but they've threatened to walk out collectively to get their employers to improve the quality of those jobs. And so that we are seeing some of that.
And we've been focusing on what I think people might look at good news for workers, low unemployment rates, jobs generally seem to be available, wages going up in many cases. There are some downsides to the economy. Of course, inflation, concerns about rising interest rates to combat inflation, worries about a recession. How much do you worry that some of the gains workers might be making will be fleeting if some of the bad news comes to the fore?
So, obviously, we want the wage gains to be real wage gains, meaning that they help workers once you account for inflation. But again, I would argue that a big part of the price rise is coming from corporate profits. And so I would like the policymakers to be careful that the policies that they enact to deal with inflation do not revert some of the gains for workers as well. I do want to say one other thing is that the pandemic exacerbated a lot of the problems that already existed prior to the pandemic. And so part of the tightness in the labor market we're seeing is from a decline in immigration starting in 2016 due to federal policies on immigration. And then, but also we have an older workforce that's been getting older, and we haven't seen the the rates of young workers to replenish those older workers. We saw a large exit of older workers during the pandemic. Some of them have come back now, presumably because of higher wages, but we're still seeing some older workers who are not going to come back. And we're still seeing, once you adjust for the pre-pandemic trend and population growth, I believe there was an estimate from the Kansas City Federal Reserve that somewhere between 2 and 3 million workers are still missing from the workforce. And so I think the pandemic sped up some of the problems that we already had in our labor market. Again, lack of immigration and older workforce versus a younger workforce.
Are there policy changes, either at the federal level or things that states could do that you think would help especially these lower wage workers in a long-term and meaningful way?
Yes, I believe so. You know, if states or the federal government could increase the federal minimum wage, that would help at the federal level lift a lot of workers out of poverty and also help workers gain power. But at the state levels, we're seeing minimum wage increases in many places. But what would help also would be policies that allow workers to collectively bargain with workers, with employers, or to join unions or form unions, anything that would allow workers to improve their power that they haven't had in the recent past and allow them to gain the productivity increases that are a function of their work rather going to corporate bottom lines. Any of those policies would be very helpful for workers in the long term.
Before we run out of time, you focus in part in your research on racial and gender equity for working families. How have you seen the pandemic affect women and people of color maybe differently over the course of the pandemic?
Yeah, that's a great question. Yes, this downturn hit women particularly hard because of the impact of COVID on caretaking responsibilities. Another thing that the COVID showed was the crisis of care that we have in this country, and women tend to do most of the care, whether it was caring for children who were forced out of schools when the shutdown, or caring for elderly relatives who their nursing home shut down, and so now they had to take care for these relatives. And so there's still many of these women out there in the out of the workforce who are still caring for folks. So women got hit pretty hard, but also minorities, Black and Latino workers and Asian workers were hit hard because of what's called occupational segregation, meaning that minorities tend to be overrepresented in industries like restaurants and bars and hotels that were particularly hit hard by the pandemic. And so we're seeing some of these groups rebound, but they're still trailing other groups, and they're still not quite to the trend before the pandemic.
We'll leave it there. Enrique, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Enrique Lopez-Lira, director of the Low Wage Work Program at the University of California, Berkeley Labor Center. He researches policies related to racial and gender equity of working families. He joined us today to look at the future of the job market and the current tight labor market, and a lot of open questions still as the pandemic goes on and affects the working world. Still time for you to share your story, by the way. If you changed your career, changed your job, left the labor market maybe earlier than planned, let us know. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Or you can always tweet us at Central Time WPR. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, more talk related to the economy. The stock market has been heading down lately with some big drops along the way, yesterday in particular. We'll look at the market downturn and what it means for the overall economy and for you. And a Milwaukee reading fan shares recommendations online. We'll get some great ideas for summer reads, and you could share yours too. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, the month of June could be the most lucrative month at the box office since before the pandemic. We'll talk to a film industry expert about the return to theaters. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.